afternoon. Welcome to Extra Sequential, your weekly dose of comic book, graphic novel, and manga news and comic book events. My name's Mladen.
My name is Chris. We're coming at you from Perth in Western Australia. This is our 30th episode discussing such things as Mladen mentioned. And today we're going to talk about Strangers in a Strange Land is our theme for today. So, you know, people, characters discovering new worlds.
Yes.
So we're going to discover comics that look at that. It's quite a unique... Well, it's actually quite a common trope in not only comics, but films and novels and all manner of things. So we've got a few, we've got five graphic novels and comics we'll be talking about that kind of sum up this Strangers in a Strange World land.
A top five, if you will.
If you will, indeed.
And we'll also be doing our usual What We've Been Reading segment and also the comic book news, which is right now. Okay. This week, oh God, like every week, is that our new introduction for the news? Because you did the same thing last week.
Well, I have to take any opportunity at a pause I can.
To go...
You should have heard me yesterday. I was talking with such a manly voice, all the ladies of the office were very impressed, you know. If only my looks could back it up, you know, I wouldn't have remained single by the end of the day.
I know, right? Did you, like, quip Dark Knight kind of things? It's what I do, no, that defines me.
Like, you know... Hello, you listen to 96 FM. This is the top hits from the 80s coming at you, right? You know,
that was unusual. You're very blokey just then.
Was I? Oh.
Don't know if I like that.
You don't mind me being a bloke? You're like, I'm more feminine.
It doesn't, does not suit you. Okay, in actual comic book news this week, I thought this was an interesting piece. Frank Miller Dark Knight, one of his Dark Knight pages, inked by Klaus Janson, is going to be auctioned for an estimated six-figure sum. And I don't know if it's happening over eBay. I assume in a more professional setting than that. But it's the iconic scene where Batman and the new girl, Robin, what was it?
Carrie
Kelly, yep.
Carrie, was it?
I think it's Carrie Kelly or something like that.
Yes, and she became Catgirl in The Dark Knight Strikes Again. It had like a leopard print.
Why would
unitard.
You bring that up? Why would you bring that terrible comic up?
Ugh. Sorry.
Ugh. But anyway, yep, that classic splash page where they're both leaping through the air, she's armed with her slingshot, I seem to recall.
Correct.
That one's going under the gavel, I think. Is the term.
Under the gun, yes.
Wow, that was
like they're auctioning off rapper's items. Yeah, so if you've got money and if you're interested, that's certainly a page to pick up. Mm. Diane Lane has been cast as Martha Kent in the untitled as yet Zack Snyder Superman reboot, which we know stars Henry Cavill. There's also been like Kevin Costner, Viggo Mortensen's names have been bandied about for General Zod, or we don't even know if Zod's going to be in it yet. But we, anyway, one thing we do know, yeah, Diane Lane, who you might remember from Judge Dredd, and a bunch of romantic comedies with Richard Gere. So, she's been cast as Martha Kent. So, no Jonathan Kent as yet, I don't think. But though I think Kevin Costner, there was talk about him being Jonathan Kent. So, that's obviously the earthly parents of Superman. All I've got to say about that.
If they recap the origin again, I'm going to lose my mind.
Yeah, I know. It seems like they do it in every film. So, I don't really think it's necessary. And I wouldn't imagine it'd be more than a cameo. I mean, because she's in her late 40s. So, she's not going to be some silverhead. Yeah. So you'd think she wouldn't be in the modern day setting, you know, where Clark Kent's going to fly home to Smallville to get some apple pie and talk about Lois with his mum. But
you don't think so?
Well, she looks too young.
Do you think so? Oh, hold on. I've got to Google Diane Lane now.
She's quite attractive. I've got a bit of a thing for her. I would say she's quite an attractive young lady. Well, not young, but middle-aged lady.
Okay. Well, for some reason she's older in my mind. But they could put prosthetics on her, I'm sure.
You're probably thinking of some other Diane, like Diane Weiss.
Who's Diane
Or Diane Weiss? Keaton.
Oh, okay. Yeah, Diane Keaton. Oh, yeah, she's an attractive lady. Okay, fair enough. I guess it will be another recapping of their... why do they... anyway.
Now's the time for your rants.
Oh, I've got to wait for the film, don't I? Yes. I probably won't see it until it's on DVD or... Sorry, no, Blu-ray now. HDTV. What's
3D.
That? What's that format that that died out?
Laserdisc?
No, the other one that was competing with Blu-ray.
Beta?
Yeah.
Okay. There's one competing with Blu-ray?
No, this is going nowhere. Remember a couple of weeks ago when we did Anthropomorphic Animals and I was talking about Floyd Gottfredson's run on the original Mickey Mouse comics straight after...
How could I forget?
Yes, a classic moment in our history of talking comics. And lo and behold, like a week after that show, they've announced that they're going to be doing proper reprints of his entire run in nice big hardcover collections. And I was just like, yes, perfect. It's been, I think it was solicited in previews a month before, so it's not news, is it? But
it'll be out soon. And this is the kind of subversive Mickey Mouse that Disney don't want your children to see.
Is that true?
Yeah, sure.
Is he subversive?
Didn't he try and kill himself?
Oh, yeah, like he tried to commit suicide.
He's punching up people and stuff. Like, this is when he's still in the infancy of the character, when he's not like the corporate mascot that he is now. This is before he was a sellout man.
Yeah, it is kind of like that, actually, because he's just an adventurer. He is a great... they put some preview panels up here, which just remind me how great it is. There's a bit where he's on his horse inside a bucket, like running down like a river and then a waterfall. And he's like, how did he get in that situation? But it's a mouse on a horse, by the way. They're not scaled correctly. He's too large. I can't read this.
Who's publishing it?
That's a fair question, and it's Fantagraphics, I think.
Okay. Yep.
They've been recently putting out a lot of good reprints, including the Prince Valiant collections. And I think they're also putting out the Carl Barks DuckTales.
You're right.
So Walt Disney Company is, you know, behind this fully. They're helping facilitate that it's going to be a proper reprint of the original, nothing altered. So anything that was slightly, you know, maybe slightly racist or anything that was 1930s, you know, stuff doesn't age well. It's just as it was then, and you know, reprinted that way. And there'll be essays by various historians. There's nice pieces here of history, original flyers, you know, like to set the scene, you know, the original covers of the magazines and stuff. So it'd be an exciting book to pick up when it comes out. And I believe it comes out on April 15th this year.
Nice one.
Yeah. Speaking of other revivals of classic characters, we announced last week that Kaboom, the subprint of Boom Studios for children's lines, will be putting out more Peanuts material. They got a license and they've announced that they're doing an original graphic novel. And it's an adaptation of the new animated film called Happiness is a Warm Blanket, Charlie Brown. So it's tying in with whatever the new animated thing is. But they've released some panels online. It looks pretty well done. Like, it looks like the old comic. They've not done any digital gradients, which is what I was really worried about.
Yeah, no, they seem to be echoing the Charlie Brown kind of standard look that we all know.
Yeah.
And the film is meant to be doing that as well. It's not like some hip manga take on the characters or whatever. It's like, you know, the films they remember from the, you know, 70s and 80s, you know, the Christmas specials and the Halloween specials and whatever it was, something about the pumpkin or something, I don't know. It was all before my youth. But, so it seems to be in that same kind of visual style. So, I mean, yeah, that's a good thing, because obviously Peanuts, a lot of people have a lot of emotional ties to that, because it's one of those kind of cultural things that have been around for decades and decades that people have fond recollections of. So, good on Boom for getting that. I don't think there'll be any original more Peanuts after this. This might be it for them, but,
Just after winning the license,
reading comics.
I reckon they'll be doing probably more. If this animated film does well, I reckon they'll be just doing animated tie-ins, book to tie-in with that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's true. Could do that.
And as you mentioned just then, hip manga adaptations. The the trailer for the new X-Men adaptation by anime studio Madhouse, I think. That's been online for a couple of weeks now, but I know you finally caught it last week. Well,
I didn't. I just looked at the character designs. But
you still haven't watched the trailer?
No, I've totally forgot. Man. I'm sorry, people, I've let you down. But the character designs, Cyclops look like a woman. He's got breasts and hips. It's very odd.
You mean pecs?
But no, like breasts. Like, you know. Things that carry milk and feed nourished babies.
Watch the actual trailer, because he doesn't look like he looks a bit more muscly in that. And you would say it's not a hoodie that he's got on. It's like you know how he has that, like, he has a
skull
hoodie, that skull cap thing. It's the skull cap when it's pulled back.
Okay.
So it looks like a hoodie. But in Japanese anime, the trope of the pretty boy, they've got a word for it, is very, very common. So usually you'll have your manly characters, and then there'll be a very effeminate young man who is meant to appeal to the young girls watching the film. Yeah, so I don't mind it being Cyclops of all of them, really. As long if it was Wolverine, you would be worried, right?
Yeah, that's true.
And I mean, The actual animation looks pretty top notch in terms of what they're doing. Looks action packed, and Beast is in it, which is great because Beast is great.
Is this the one that's written by Warren Ellis? He was doing an Iron Man and something else, a Wolverine and an X-Men film, I think, all written by Warren Ellis.
I don't know if he's tied to this project. I think that was the... no, I think that's a different project. I know this one they journey to Japan for some reason. And so they can have Japanese characters, and it's in a setting that's suitable for Japanese viewers. And I'm fine with it. Yep. Looks well done. No one is... there's no gender swaps. So...
A couple of Oscar winners.
Ooh.
Aussies as well. We didn't win all the Oscars. Jeffrey Rush and Jackie Weaver didn't win for Best Supporting Actor and Actress, but Aussies, Sean Tan, one who we actually met, saw, and we were actually one of the first people to actually watch this Oscar-winning film, The Lost Thing, rated by musician-comedian Tim Minchin. So, yeah, that one for Best Animated Short, The Lost Thing, which is it's out on DVD now. It's been out for a while. Especially about, it's like a CGI based on Sean Tan, who does a lot of wordless graphic novels like The Arrival. Mm-hmm. And this is based on the book of the same name. So, congratulations to Sean Tan, because I know it took years and years to actually get this film made. So, congrats to him. Mm-hmm. Also, someone who hasn't been getting much press at all, Dave Elsie. He's the cover artist of the Dark Detective Sherlock Holmes books from Black House Comics, Australian publisher. We mentioned these during Detective. Episode last year. Mm-hmm. So this is they have the great photo covers. The look, if your mind can cast back that far, young Leakerton.
I don't.
So Dave also he won best the Oscar for best makeup for The Wolfman, which was a great film starring Anthony Hopkins and Benicio del Toro, and directed by Joe Johnston. I think he's directing the Captain America film. Which will be out in July, but yeah, so he won Best Makeup for The Wolfman, so congratulations to both Sean Tan and Dave Elsie.
Isn't that movie supposed to be pretty terrible?
It's not that great, but it had a pretty troubled life. Like the initial director walked out halfway through, so
why.
The guy that came on only had a couple of months to make sense of it, but it's entertaining enough.
Okay.
Only Press, indie publisher Only Press, who do Gorillaz, Queen of Country, a whole bunch of stuff. They've just released something called the Only Press Mixtape, which is a free download at adamwarrick.com. And there's this nerdcore rapper called Adam Warrick, which is WARWARROCK. Mm-hmm. And you can get it at his website, which is adamwarrick.com. And basically, it's about, I think, a dozen tracks inspired by Only Press's different series. And he's using samples and beats and all the musical terminology that someone of your stellar musical history would use that I'm unfamiliar with. But I've actually downloaded it, but I've yet to listen to it. But if you like kind of music about comics, and we talked about this last week, adamwarrick.com. And another band worth listening to is Kirby Crackle, who've released a couple of albums and got a couple of music videos out, and I actually saw them in San Diego a couple of years ago, and it's basically just two guys, but they're a lot more nerdcore friendly, so they sing about superheroes and all that kind of stuff, and their songs are pretty amusing. Kind of Weird Al Yankovic for the Gig Brigade, I guess you could say. So it kind of ties into last week's theme, but this has just come out now. So Adam Warrick and KirbyCrackle.com, check them out. That's all I've got for new news, my friend.
Me too. Let's get into what we've been reading. Just before we started recording, I was watching Evil Dead 2, the classic Sam Raimi film.
What's that line he has on that? Like, sugar, show me some sugar or something?
That's in, I think that's in Army of Darkness. In this one, he doesn't do as many one-liners, but he has groovy and now who's laughing and that sort of stuff. Yeah, give me back my hand. Huh? No, that's in the next one. They call it the boomstick. And yeah, I always forget how fun that movie is. So much, like, every scene you're like, oh, what are they going to throw at me now? Like, you can't predict where it's going to go. Like, what insane insanity they're going to do. It's very enjoyable. I mean, you know when you hear horror fans telling you how fun horror movies are?
Yeah.
This is like
not really.
Yeah, exactly. I don't normally see at all where they're coming from. But with this film, I'm like, yeah, okay, I get it. this is funny and it's fun.
And, well, yeah, lately horror movies just haven't been funny or fun, have they? They've all been, you know, like torture porn and that, as we, you know, like the Hostel and Saw, yeah, and those kind of movies. But yeah, they're not as fun anymore. I guess the closest thing would be the grindhouse flicks, like Planet Terror and what's the one that Tarantino did? Death Proof.
Yeah, but I heard those were both pretty terrible. Honestly,
they weren't. No, Planet Terror was pretty amusing, but yeah, they weren't like hugely as much fun as the Evil Dead films. Weren't the talk of remaking the Evil Dead films?
Really?
I hope not.
CG. And in the same terms of remaking, the Thing remake is, I think, nearly done.
So, oh, yes.
Because cool. I was thinking of Practical Puppets just then, and the Thing also has that kind of craziness in it, except it's not meant to be funny. And yeah, that remake, I think Joel Edgerton's in it.
Oh, okay, yes. And Scott Pilgrim's girlfriend.
Oh, really? Big-eyed.
What's her face? Who played John McClane's daughter, Elizabeth someone.
Yeah. Oh, was she John McClane's daughter in Die Hard 4.0?
Correct.
Live Free or Die Hard? Was that the song?
That's the one.
What do you think of that film?
Yes, I actually bought the whole pack for like $20 recently. And the thing is, like, the first one, I remember watching the first one, and I think we talked about this before, like, it was such a revelation, because I actually watched Commando not that long ago either, which is from, like, the same era, I think the year before. Mary Elizabeth Winstead. There we go.
Thank you. Elizabeth.
And there's no plot in Commando. He's basically just going around shooting people. Whereas
Jenny!
Die Hard was like a... it's just, yeah, like you said, a revelation. You know, he's running around with bleeding feet and all that. And then after each successive, well, the second or third Die Hard, it was still kind of believable, even though I didn't like it. Third one being set in a big city. Like, I like the premise of the Die Hard films should be stuck somewhere, you know.
I don't remember the second one.
In the airport.
I don't remember that one being good at all, but I do like the idea of it being in an airport, so
It was better than I thought when I watched it again, but the fourth one, he was invincible, and it just could have been anybody, you know. He's throwing, you know, driving cars into helicopters, and he wasn't getting injured, he wasn't, you know what I mean, he could have been any Steven Seagal film, but with a bigger budget. So I didn't,
you could imagine Tom Cruise in that role, even, you know.
Yeah,
it could
exactly
be a Mission Impossible,
but they have been talking that Bruce Willis wants to do two more, and that's it. So Die Hard 24/7, I think, is the last, as the fifth one, and then after the sixth one they'll do it. But there was criticisms that, yeah, the fourth one, John McClane was just some invincible Superman, you know. Yeah. So hopefully they'll scale that back down a bit, because that's what made the first one so enjoyable. Mm-hmm. I've also been playing Killzone 3 on my PlayStation 3. That's just been released, so I picked that up a few days ago, and that's a good sci-fi shooter. Quite hard, because I'm dying a lot, but, you know, the friends that you play with, the computer controls, can revive you pretty quickly.
Okay.
So, it's actually a pretty good game. The graphics are awesome. It's, like, made for 3D TVs and stuff, which I don't have, and it's also compatible with the Move, which is the PlayStation version of the Wii, but I haven't put that into practice as yet, but, that's a pretty good game. I've also been reading, I actually bought this fairly cheaply off Amazon, The Making of the Empire Strikes Back.
Wow, cool. That sounds good.
It's a hefty tome. Yeah, I'll have to lend it to you. It's huge. When I got delivered at the office, I left it on my desk, and all the guys, you know, like my age, were like, ogling it, you know. They're like, oh, when can I borrow it? It's like 360 pages.
Yeah.
It's a huge coffee table hardcover book, and it basically goes through the whole development process. Mm-hmm. The guy that's doing him, J.W. Rinsler, he's an author, obviously, and he's an executive editor at Lucasfilm. So he's basically got access to all the Lucasfilm archives.
Mm-hmm.
And in the introduction, he tells how he got these, because this is the second time he's done this. He does it for the 30th anniversary of each film. So the making of the Star Wars, he did that a couple of years ago. And obviously the making of Return of the Jedi will be next. He's also done a similar thing for Indiana Jones. But this is all based on original interviews from the cast and crew at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not Harrison Ford and, you know, George Lucas reflecting back on, but it's all based on interviews during the late 70s when
this
was made.
Because I was going to ask. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting, because the guy says that there was just some kind of stagehand or something at Lucasfilm when the films were being made. He saved all the original press interviews from the trash can, like cans and cans of. And this guy, the author, G.W. Ringsley, he just ran. He found out about these and found them in the archives. So he's been kind of listening to them and taking notes. So it's interesting to actually listen to. I mean, I'm only about 20 pages in, but it just sounds like a nightmare because Lucas actually financed this film himself. And he had to get money from the banks, and he was saying how revolutionary his deal with Star Wars, which took like about 1.5 to 2 years to fund, because he wanted more of the percentage than the studios. No one believed in it. The studios actually wanted to offload it and get rid of Star Wars because they just thought it was a piece of garbage. And so, yeah, it's actually pretty, just the vision of the guy as a man, it's actually quite inspiring as a fellow wannabe writer, just to see his notebooks and his loose notes.
Okay.
And then he actually hired other people to, you know, as screenwriters to take over from that.
Is there a lot of content from, was it Gary Kurtz? Because I know...
yes, he's in here. I've read a few quotes from him. This is still in his when he was still getting along with Lucas. So, because I don't think he... Did he leave before Return of the Jedi?
Yeah, he left before Return of the Jedi, and I'd be very... I really hope Return of the Jedi book... I haven't read the Empire Strikes Back one, but I recall seeing promo material for it. But I really hope this third one, because it's being prepared by an outside party, I guess, it'll be honest and give, you know, his honest opinions on where the project was going and why he left. And I think that would be more important than just kind of a big pat on the back book. But from what you're describing, it is or it isn't a pat on the back book? What do you reckon?
It's pretty honest so far. I mean, because, Lucas is, you know, he's just, you can tell he wrote and directed Star Wars, and he said, you know, and that was the first time he hasn't done that since the prequels. So he was just, you know, like, he had enough after Star Wars, and The Empire Strikes Back is when his marriage is falling apart, and he's just fed up with the studios. And so you get that. It's actually quite an honest and quite a raw account into, I mean, you think there'd be a fair bit of behind the scenes stuff published on Star Wars already, but I'm a sucker for all this stuff, which is not why I never watch pirate DVDs. And yeah, it's got a whole bunch of artwork from Ralph McQuarrie, and you can see the evolution of, you know, like Boba Fett and all the characters that showed up in Empire. It's a lavish looking book. It's made by Ballantine Books and Del Rey. It's available now. It's got a foreword by Ridley Scott. It's called The Making of The Empire Strikes Back. And as Maladin said, there's some pretty good previews online. And I'm tempted to pick up The Making of Star Wars now, actually.
Lovely.
Yeah.
I read a couple of things. The first one I want to talk about is Digested, which is a comic by a Melbourne-based cartoonist called Bobby N. He's 4 issues in now, and he's been putting them out over the last couple of years, obviously just in his part-time, so, you know, you put them out when you can. I picked up issues 2 and 3, just because they looked interesting, and I'd heard...
They're from Gestalt, I think.
That's correct, yeah. Gestalt's lucky to get a lot of really good talent on board, especially Oscar-winning Sean Tan, who's involved with Gestalt. So Digested is from that publisher there, and it's Bobby N's... autobiographical, semi-autobiographical, kind of little vignettes, but they're not really about him and his life. They're more about his observations of things that happen. And one of my favorite short... It's a series of shorts, really, and then over each issue, he's continuing a couple of kind of continuing stories, the main one, which is called Oxygen, where there's the gas masks kind of double as a symbol of the modern world, I guess, like when the kid gets his 6th birthday or something, he gets his gas mask in a box, and then he's never the same afterwards. He just sits at the TV and does nothing, and then it reveals this mystery of his feeding this creepy thing at night when he grows up and what's going on there. But one of my favorite stories in this one is it's a little vignette of his own personal experience, Bobby N's, I should say, of having an interview with his boss, because he leaves every day, you know, at 5 p.m., which is his working time, and then the boss is, like, having a go at him, and it's kind of him realizing they're screwing him over. He's working his minimum hours, you know, and he's like, what are you talking about, minimum hours? I'm working my hours, you know. Yes. And it's just a really interesting little conversation to read, and the expressions he draws. I mean, his cartooning style is, like, I think it's pretty... it's surprisingly sophisticated. Like, at a glance, you might think, oh, it's pretty simple because it's kind of cartoonish. But when you see the kind of little things he's doing, he has a lot of freedom to do expressions, and the skill he has in actually rendering a scene with minimum of lines, you can see that he's really it's not a simple comic by any means.
No, it's very it's very clean line, and all the people look different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've got like slightly bigger heads and slightly bigger hands, and this is. I mean, I've only got the first two issues. They're kind of like little digest.
Yes.
They're quite a little floppy, but you can see that there's so much effort and there's a lot of detail, and as you said, quite obvious, there's so much thought, not actually in the artwork, but in the page design and the pacing and stuff. And it's like, I just remember the first one in particular just being like laugh out loud funny.
Yeah, they are really funny, and in a kind of in an observing these things that are around us kind of way, there's just some of the stories are like insane or not realistic, and some are very realistic. Yeah. So there's one which is him at the train station waiting for his train, and then he's describing the etiquette. You know, you wait for everyone to get off before you get on, and then some douche in a suit just marches through and sits down. Yes. And nobody says a word to him, and you can see everyone, like, he's like, and we're all fuming inside, but no one says a word. I'm like, yeah, that's kind of what it's like. You don't do anything when someone does that.
Yeah.
Another one with a teddy bear and a little girl, which was really funny. Yes. As well, which I won't spoil either. But yeah, really good ones to check out. If you're all into Australian comics, I'd say this is one of my favourite ones right now, so I'll be following this.
There's, as you said, there's four different issues out now. They're all available from Gestalt Publishing, and also from his website, which is bobbyendsblog.blogspot.com. And it looks like they're only $5, so go for it. It's well worth your time to get.
That's right. One of the issues, I think, is like four times longer. It's 64 pages, actually, that one just issue two, and that one's slightly more, and it's still well worth it. And at the end, there's little interviews with him and other people, so it's really cool. What else have you been reading?
I was reading on the train yesterday, actually, the latest issue of the Brightest Day miniseries that DC have been publishing, bi-weekly miniseries, so Brightest Day 21. I've talked about this, last week, I think, because Aquaman got his hand chopped off, but this is all about Martian Manhunter, who's the green bald guy who some people might be familiar with from Justice League Unlimited. It's quite funny because it's a gorgeous looking book, and there was the guy sitting next to me the whole way just kept looking over my shoulder, and I always make sure that I read comics in public as often as I can.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I spend like 2 hours a day on the train, even though I'm moving house next week, so I won't be spending as much, but and I always make sure to open the pages nice and wide and give everybody a big look, because 9 times out of 10 someone will have a look, because people just don't see comics very often. And this was interesting because there's like 3 double splash pages and 1 single page splash page, and there's like 20 something page comics. That's quite funny, and it's all very dramatic. There's lots of shouting, as all good superhero comics should have. So it's basically a Martian Manhunter centered issue, so if you do like Martian Manhunter, you find out why he came back to life, what the White Ring is doing, and he kind of has to choose between his love of Earth and his love of Mars. That wouldn't mean much if you're not reading the series, but it's well worth it. I've also, just this morning, I just had a quick flick through Carbon Grey from Image Comics, which has actually faced a fair bit of harsh reviews online.
Oh, really?
It's one of those Image comics that had a fair bit of buzz about it. It's had like 8 years in the making, and it's pretty interesting. It's written, the story is by Kerry Evans, Paul Gardner, Mike Kennedy, and Huang Nian, and the art is by Kerry Evans, Kim Sun Lo, and Huang Yun, and the script and lettering is by Paul Gardner. Basically, it's like a steampunk fantasy, bit of sci-fi elements. It needs another read because it looks good. It's about as much as I can say.
Oh, really?
About it.
Okay.
It does have a lot of steampunk elements. It talks about the Sisters Grey. There's like the 14th sister in the line is meant to like break the, I don't know. It looks very good, but there's like busty women. There's one guy, it's like a secret agent guy who like sleeps with one of these girls, but then when he wakes up in the morning, he realizes his face has changed, so he no longer reveals his identity papers.
Mm.
She reveals that it's because she put some kind of gel on her breasts. So when she was like,
I'm getting the impression you didn't like this comic, right?
Putting his hand in her breast, her face, his face changed. It looks awesome. There's a lot of blood and it's very mangery, very, very stylish.
I think you're too kind to some comics because
it does need, and this is what every other reviewer said, it needs work on its story. It is kind of hard to tell what's going on here. There's no definite characters to kind of hook your hat on.
Okay.
There's like a page sequence that looks like it's almost from World War One. There's like a multi-page sequence that quotes a poem by Howard Marber called The Garden that just seems to kind of come out of nowhere. It basically kind of reminds me of Sucker Punch. It's like sexy women glorifying violence, mm-hmm. but nowhere near as appealing as that. I really wanted to like this comic because the preview art that I saw online looks great. I knew that it took these guys like 8 years to make it, and it seems like a good idea, like it's coming from a good place of concepts, but it really needs to be more focused and tidied up a bit before it becomes much more appealing. It's called Carbon Grey, number one. If you're new to comics, I wouldn't recommend it, but if you're interested in some great art, it's worth buying just for the art alone. But unfortunately, that's not enough for comics, because we know it's not just a visual medium. Mm. So, yeah, that's what I've been reading and watching and playing this week.
Okay. Speaking of great art, I decided this week I really wanted to delve into the work of a French artist called César. He worked pretty heavily in the Metal Hallon, which is a heavy metal of France, in the 70s to 80s. And I think he's still working. But César is the pseudonym of Philippe Sazamois, I'm guessing, something like that. I don't know. That's probably terrible.
What's but, that guy in the Adams? Was it the Adams family? He always used to talk French and drive his wife wild.
The main guy?
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, he did, didn't he? I need to rewatch that remake film.
Yeah, they were quite good, the films.
Yeah, it had
they made two of them.
That girl in it.
Christina
Ricci. That was like her first film, wasn't it?
Yeah, that and Casper.
Oh, why'd you run me that?
That was in Black Snake Moan.
Yep.
Alpha.
And Monster.
Oh, yes. Yes,
that's
yes.
Right. But, no, César, C-A-Z-A, if you want to look him up. His style is very recognizable. He's got this really painstaking pointillist pen work. So pointillism is where you build up an image just through dots. So that's how you render instead of line work, it's dots. And he typically focuses on the nude human form, like a lot of 70s artists will want to do, which is fine. Science fiction content and like really organic technology. And later on, he augmented his style by adding like color, but it was still extremely detailed. So like he simplified his process so he could start the stories quicker. And many of his stories are short because of the artist style. So I read three of his shorter stories from Heavy Metal. The first one I read was called Hydrogenesis, which is wordless. It's like six splash pages, one after the other, black and white piece. And it's kind of this amorphous story, which it's not very literal, like this liquid mass, like which is kind of metallic, takes the form of a beautiful woman, ascends to the stars and gives birth to the universe. And it's like really beautiful. Beautifully drawn. That was like from 75. Next one I read was called Planet of Terror, and that was from 1977, I believe. And it's kind of a story of himself. I got that impression. Well, the writer actually is Paul Lamontellieri. I don't know. So I'm guessing a story of him, I should say. But it's kind of an allegory for him feeling imprisoned in the modern world, because he's going up in his elevator, he presses a button, and then he's imprisoned in this grey sphere, grey box, which is a skyscraper, basically, and he's tested on and all this stuff, and the only escape he has is drawing these comics, which he throws out the window, and then there's all these sexual metaphors, which are mirrored later, like the button he pushes in the lift. Later on, there's a nipple, which looks just like that button. So it's pretty clever stuff. But it's like really restrained palette until the end. And then it's explosion of hippie colors, frees himself through artwork and sex. I'm like, cool. And the last one I want to mention, because it's this intense cosmic story again. It's called The Ark, and originally was in Metal Hurlant, I think in 82, and it's about this organic ark, which is kind of closed and waiting, and all the beasts on Earth are trying to get into it, but then the water's rising, you know, you've got your Noah's Ark thing. Thousands of years pass, the ark's hermetically sealed, so it sinks to the bottom of the floor, covered with ooze, the Earth dries, it bakes, you know, everything happens, Earth, wind, fire, water, all that stuff. The universe ends, and then you see this egg, which was the ark, and it survived, and it's the genesis of the universe, and just beautifully drawn, richly detailed, like just intense, like intense to read and look at, and you can really get that science fiction vibe. So really, all of these were really entertaining science fiction comics, gorgeously drawn. And I'm pretty sure you could pick up reprints here and there, but as we know, heavy metal comics, you can usually... There's a good chance if you're picking up a heavy metal comic, one of the earlier ones, some of his work will be in it. So... there's a good chance you've read any if you've ever read Heavy Metal. So, yeah. But I really liked it. So that was César. I think every couple of weeks I might try and dig up older 70s artists and just kind of dip into their work. Like, as a newcomer, you know, because I've never read any of his stuff before. Have you seen any of these before, or have you looked them up?
No, I do recall my brother buying heavy metal when we were kids, but you know, not that familiar with that or Metal Hurlant, I must admit.
Well, this is well worth it, so if you can find it, go for it. And that's really all I've been reading this week.
I did want to mention, so I was talking about Carbon Grey, I did watch Resident Evil Afterlife last night, which reminded me of another nice-looking but ridiculous plot kind of look to our storytelling. Yeah, the Resident Evil films are just getting more and more ridiculous. I don't know why I watch them, but yeah, I mean, this was like it was made for 3D, and it's just, it's almost like on, you know, this like slow motion ballet, and you know, she's flying through the air, and it's like, I mean, it's written and directed by his wife, so it almost like, you know, Mila Jovovich's wife's husband, he plays the main character, Alice. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's all kind of a love letter to her action abilities. But something far superior, also watched Buried, the Ryan Reynolds stuck in a coffin movie for 90 minutes, yeah. And it is awesome, and you should watch it.
Do you reckon I'd like it?
I love it. See, Alfred Hitchcock is one of my favourite, well, probably is my favourite director, and this is very much like that. Yeah, it's set in a coffin for 90 minutes, but it only stars Ryan Reynolds. It's interesting, I'm at the IMDb page now, and it's got cast Ryan Reynolds, Paul Conroy, everybody else is a voice only. So he has to carry the film by himself because it's basically just him, a flashlight, a phone. There's a bit where he has to attack a snake in the coffin, and basically he's a truck driver in Iraq, and we find out that his convoy gets attacked, and there's like a hostage. He's a hostage, and he gets videos sent to him on his phone, and he's trying to reconnect with his son and his wife while he realizes he's dying, and you know, someone demands money from him and stuff, and sort of kind of the bureaucracy of the state government trying to help him, and it's kind of a race against time. The hostage negotiators and army are calling him, and oh man, the first like five, six minutes are just black with Ryan Reynolds just panting in panic. Mm-hmm. And even that is just mesmerizing, and it just, you can't look away.
Wow.
And it looks good as well. Like, I mean, it's directed in such a way that the lighting is different because he has his flashlight, he has a torch, he has a lighter. Mm. So it's actually lit quite well. And just Ryan Reynolds is just a superb actor. So, in this film at least. So, it's called Buried. Don't be put off by the 90 minutes in a coffin premise. It's a very suspenseful and a great thriller.
Awesome. That was cool. I reckon we should get into our feature topic of Strangers in a Strange Land straight after this little musical break. Strangers in a Strange Land. Now, when Chris suggested this topic to me last week, I really kind of struggled to nail down just a few, because it's not super common, but it's a very common kind of trope in a lot of fiction, and I mean, you do see it in a fair bit, and I think we had to kind of limit ourselves that it really has to be someone who is an adult, so they have their own context, you know, their own culture, and then they're immersed in this other foreign culture, which is odd and strange to them, and then there's the strange customs which they have to deal with. And you see it a lot in science fiction. E.T. You see the other way around. So like an alien visiting Earth is also a stranger in a strange land. So you got E.T. and the famous Robert Heinlein book, which is actually called Strangers in a Strange Land. And that's very good as well. But in terms of comics, I think we had an embarrassment of riches to choose from. Is that your impression as well?
Yeah, well, and I was thinking about this. I was thinking, yes, and you're right. And I was going through my bookshelf and... I've been a bit sick this week, so I only managed to read a couple, but I did have more that I wanted to get to. But it is very common in, as you said, not only comics but films. And I was kind of thinking as I was running through them in my mind that they almost fall into two separate camps.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's the ones that are realistic in the world that they're set in, that person travels to, like you said, an exotic land, discovers different cultures, they kind of step outside their own world for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Indiana Jones could loosely fall into that, Star Wars, I guess, even, you know, the farmer's kid growing up and discovering the galaxy and seeing what the Force is and all that kind of stuff. Lord of the Rings would be the ultimate example, I guess, you know, hobbits leaving the Shire for the first time and discovering this big world. But then there's the other side of things where there's a different reality, like a different mirrored or leveled reality. I guess Alice in Wonderland would be the ultimate example of that, like through a portal or whatever, like The Matrix, Pan's Labyrinth.
And historically, it's pretty rich. I mean, you've got Gulliver's Travels and
Utopia. Chronicles of Narnia.
Yeah, the old Utopia novel.
Yeah, that's true. Even the Adjustment Bureau, I guess, the Emily Blunt, Matt Damon film could loosely connect to that. Like, he gets his eyes open to this other world of, you know, bowler-hatted man trying to decide the fate of the world. So, yeah, it is a common trope. But it has to start with someone's world already being normal and then having that normalcy shattered.
Mm. And I think we set each other some rules for this. I mean, we decided to not include examples of, say, someone realizing the world they already live in is very, very different to what they had imagined. And we also needed to exclude things like Superman, because even though his story is an immigrant tale, he was a baby. So really, he doesn't have that culture clash element at all, except in those tales where he goes into outer space, from what I remember, and there's an animated version of that as well. Yeah, that's true.
And this, I guess, perhaps another version of this would be alternate worlds or alternate histories, and superheroes just love that stuff. It's coming in Marvel Comics are doing it now in the Age of X miniseries, and DC are doing it in the coming months, in their Flashpoint miniseries that sees Aquaman and Flash and a whole bunch of characters kind of reinterpreted in different alternate futures. So I guess that's a kind of spin-off of The Strangers in a Strange World. Okay. But yeah, we've certainly got a lot to talk about today.
Okay. My first item in my list of five, and it was the first one I really thought of, and I was tossing up between two famous Franco-Belgian characters, Asterix and Tintin. Now, Asterix and Tintin are well known for basically being the traveling, kind of almost not tourists, but they're like the traveling adventurers. A lot of the adventures take place in all sorts of places in the world. And it's not fair to group them because they are very different comics in tone. But Asterix, you know, he goes to Germany, Rome, Egypt, Britain, like Greece for the Olympic Games, Spain, Switzerland, Corsica, Belgium, Middle East, India, like he goes everywhere. And Tintin's the same, you know, Russia, Congo, America, Egypt, China, the moon, you know, Tibet, South America, Amazon Island, like everywhere, and sort of weighing up between all of those. But I think one which really I enjoyed the culture clash thing the most was Asterix and the Great Crossing, which is the one where he goes to America by accident. They go out fishing, and then Obelix throws out their net but doesn't tie it to the boat because he's an idiot, and then they get caught in the storm and sort of end up in America, like, over the course of a week, I'd imagine, and because it's not a quick trip, I don't think. But they gloss over that anyway. They think they've landed back on their own country, or they're like, maybe we're in Spain. And then they see Native Americans, are like, they kind of look Spanish, and there's the culture clash there, and they set up for this great gag in it where Asterix and Obelix are trying to act out their. Who they are, like trying to explain about language. So they're acting out the things they do, like they hunt Romans, they do all this stuff, and then the Native Americans are looking at each other like, these guys are nuts. And the whole thing is just kind of them, you know, cultural misunderstandings, you know, his challenge to fight, so he just smacks the guy in the face and that's it. Little things here and there, and then Vikings land in the Americas, which historically people have always sort of suspected was true. And then they think Asterix and Obelix are natives, so they're offering them these riches, and they're looking at them and going, they don't look very foreign. it's a really good one for that Strangers in a Strange Land theme. And again, like, I really just had to pick one out of 60-plus Asterix and Tintin comics, and that one to me really summed up that kind of clash. And there's a great bit where the Indian chief wants Obelix to marry his daughter, and he's like, no, she's fat. And if anyone knows who Obelix is, like, he's incredibly fat.
Rotund.
He's, he's incredibly rotund, and she's like just a little bit curvy, and he's like, no, she's too fat for me. Yeah, so that's my number five. What's number four, Chris?
Published by Vertigo Comics, written by G. Willow Wilson, and art is by M.K. Perker. This was one of those books that was wildly acclaimed by the critics, but wasn't really purchased much by the readers, which seems to be the case with a lot of Vertigo series over the last couple of years. So I think this only lasted 2 years, 24 issues. There's four trades out now. I've just read the first one. And it's cheap, so I do recommend picking it up. It's like $10 for 144 pages. And basically, it's I think G. Willow Wilson is like a... She's a female writer, and I think she's a journalist kind of specializing in like the Middle Eastern kind of affairs and politics and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you read comics sometimes, and I got this feeling when I started reading like Nathan Edmondson's work, because I know he was new to comics, and I get the same feeling here, that it's kind of a refreshing take. So it opens with, you know, basically just two people falling from the sky, and then goes and backtracks by then. But it focuses on an air hostess called Blythe, and she's an unusual air hostess because she's afraid of heights. But nonetheless, she travels from place to place, as air hostesses do, and she meets this guy called Zane, Z-A-Y-N, who's like this mysterious suave, I guess would be the way to describe him, kind of Spanish-Mexican kind of looking guy, and he shows up on her different flights, but under different names and wearing different clothes and stuff. So we get the sense that this guy is a bit weird, or like, what's up with him? And when she first meets him, she kind of, you know, thinks that he's like a terrorist or something. And her cohort goes, racial profiling much, you know, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then she basically gets to see this bigger world through Zane. And we realize that there's this place called the Artesian Front, who are these basically these guys who want to take back the skies from terrorism. And they ask her to kind of take this suitcase and meet her, get someone else to meet her on the other side of the world, which she naively does after one of them helps her with an unruly customer on one of her flights. So this Zane guy keeps showing up, and we realise that he's actually a good guy, and the Artesian Fronts are the bad guys, effectively.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually this Zane guy gets kidnapped, and he's discovered in this place called Narramar. And the interesting thing is that the story soon takes a kind of almost a metaphysical turn. Like, it's been pretty realistic, I guess, up to that stage. It almost seems like a loose spy thriller, Jason Bourne, politics terrorist kind of thing. And then it takes this weird, well, not a weird U-turn, but it kind of takes a turn nonetheless. We discover that this place called Narramar has basically disappeared off the map, that there's no record of it anymore. 50 years ago, it's seceded from India, and no one really knows it exists anymore. So now Blythe kind of has to learn, now that she's fallen in love with this Zane guy, how to find him, how to get back there. And that she learns that she's one of these people called hyperprax, which have this ability to almost teleport in a sense, but not in a traditional sense, but kind of navigate through your sixth sense and find this kind of hidden country. Once she does that, a whole bunch of weirdness opens up, and then she gets kidnapped and goes to this floating city. She meets Amelia Earhart, famed real historical figure, female aviator,
mm-hmm.
played by Hilary Swank, I think, in a movie a while ago. So it's actually pretty charming. I mean, the art is interesting. The faces are a bit off by M.K. Perker. The faces are a bit off in places, but the art's nonetheless good. And it's printed on relatively cheap paper, which I think Vertigo does for most of their trades, which doesn't isn't a negative thing at all. At least it makes it quite affordable. But, yeah, it's quite an interesting story. It's quite, as I said, it's quite metaphysical. It's not action-packed by any means, but, you know, she has, like, dreams about, you know, kind of feathery serpent creatures, and there's a lot of stuff about, you know, seeing what's not there and discovering new worlds and, you know, can we really believe people who they say they are, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't read comics before, I would recommend it. It's, as I said, it's been widely praised. It's called Air. The first volume is called Letters from Lost Countries, which is an apt title, and there's four volumes, and they're all available now. It's a pretty good series. Just to, it's kind of like, I guess if you like Lost, or, you know, that kind of show, which is loosely grounded in reality, but kind of has metaphysical, you know, kind of pseudo-scientific things spinning off from it that sometimes raises more questions than it gives answers to. I think if you like Lost and those kind of shows, then I think Air would be right up your alley. It's from Vertigo, and it's available now. And the story is finished as well, so four volumes isn't that expensive. You can pick them all up for $40. So I suppose in that way, at least it's good it's finished, because you can get a complete story.
Great. I mean, you mentioned...
Are you that familiar with it?
I have read the first trade of it. Okay. It seemed interesting, kind of not down the rabbit hole thing, but just that kind of dimension bending Vertigo tale that they do as a label title, I should say, they do a little bit of, and they do it quite well, because they tend to give their writers pretty free rein to do what they want.
Yeah.
Also in Vertigo, Neil Gaiman, as we both know, is probably the most prolific in this genre. I mean, really, a lot of his stories, even in Sandman, which rarely follows around the titular character, it tends to follow just new characters, normal people being introduced to that strange world and having a very odd adventure. He also had a 1996 TV series called Neverwhere, which where the main character explores the the London below, which is kind of this mirror world of London. So like London Bridge takes on a new significance, you know, different stuff like that. And there was also a comic adaptation of that in 2005. Also, you have Coraline from the 2009 film based on his 2002 novel, and that's where Coraline Jones visits the other world where there's doppelgangers of her parents who have buttons in place of her eyes.
Ah, yes.
But the main comic that I wanted to talk about, and this will be the number three, is his The Books of Magic, and that came out through Vertigo Comics in 1993 in four volumes. Each volume had a different artist on board. It was John Bolton, Scott Hampton, Charles Vess, and Paul Johnson, who should all be... they should all be recognizable to anyone who's read 90s Vertigo comics, even if you don't know their names. Through the course of this comic, a young spectacled, nerdy lad called Timothy Hunter, who has a surprising resemblance to Harry Potter, and yes. Other people have commented that it's because both series are about a young boy being introduced to the world of magic. Anyway, I won't comment any more on that. Neil Gaiman has said it's a coincidence. It's how many different types of characters could you choose? Like a nerdy kid with glasses? Come on, you know. So he's saying it's just a coincidence. People, back off. I'm sure she didn't rip me off. So I'm like, he's a gentleman. He really is. But through the course of the comic, through all four comics, he's singled out by John Constantine, the Phantom Stranger, Dr. Occult, and Mr. E. Some of who will be known as kind of famous DC Comics magicians. And he's singled out by them as being potentially someone of great power later. So they decide to kind of give him a tour of all the different kind of magical realms and all the established DC magical characters. So through the course of everything, he meets Zatara, Dr. Fate, the Spectre, Madame Xanadu, Zatanna, Cain and Abel, and Dream, you know, from Sandman. And, He sort of toured around like the real world and all the magicians there, but then he also goes through the past. He goes to hell and all the fantasy worlds of DC Comics and the future and the end of all things, and also the world of fairy, which is kind of their kind of imaginary world. And that's kind of the most interesting one in terms of he's the tourist through the whole thing. So these guys, he's like his tour guides in this whole world, and he's just a normal kid, and he takes it in like a normal kid. Like after the first couple of volumes, the shock of the magic just wears off for him. So he's just like, okay, what's your thing? What do you do? And then like when someone's saying something mystical and magical, you must not touch the thing, magic has a cost. He's like, yeah, I know, but get on with it. Like he sees through the crap after a while, and it's fun. And there's like a brief little thing I'll read, which is just before Dr. Occult takes him into like the magical realm, and he gives him like this little spiel of what to do and what not to do, and it's almost like a little tourist guidebook. And he tells him to listen to him carefully. Firstly, on our journey, you must obey my orders explicitly and in all things, no matter how petty or strange they seem to you. Secondly, ask no questions or favors of those you meet on our travels, and accept no gifts, food, stuffs, or favors, save with my blessing. Thirdly, remember your manners, etiquette will be important where we go, and good manners are gold. For a trivial impoliteness, you could find yourself gifted with ass's ears or worse. Lastly, never stray from the path, no matter what you see or hear or feed or feel. Sorry, do you understand? And I'm like, that's good advice for a lot of magic backpackers. Yeah, if more backpackers listened to that advice, we'd live in a safer world. It really is like it's as well as Timothy being introduced to all these different magical things, and at the end deciding whether he wants to be a magician or not. And there's he's being fought over during the course of the novel by the forces of darkness, and at the end, one of his guides tries to do away with him, which is really interesting. Like, he basically takes him to the end of all things in the universe and wants to kill him and strand him there because he can't travel back in time on his own, and then death intervenes. You know, the famous Neil Gaiman death, the lady version. It's the really entertaining. Yeah, the kind of the goth death, yeah. Really entertaining comic, but it's not just him being introduced. It's a great story to introduce a new reader of Vertigo and DC Comics to all the Vertigo DC magical things that tie into their main universe. So yes. For me, like, a lot of the characters I really didn't recognize, and then others I did, and they had this new relevance to me, and the others which I didn't still made sense, but I was looking at them from Timothy's point of view. So it's yourself as the reader are also kind of the stranger in the strange land, and I thought it's really effective as a weird little guidebook. And there's a great bit where he keeps meeting, I think it's Dead Man, who was another circus performer who died.
Yep.
And he can take over people's bodies, can't he?
Yeah, he's showing up at their brightest days.
That's series. Right.
Yes.
They never use his Dead Man name. He just appears to the kid in these different bodies. He's like, hey, kid, I've got some advice for you, that kind of stuff. And he mentions the character's name. So I'm like, why does that name sound familiar? And they never reveal...
Boston Brand.
Yeah, I'm like, that name sounds very familiar. And he's giving the kid advice. So there's like all these little in things for people who know this world and are familiar with it can go, oh, yeah, that's that guy. But for Timothy, he's like, oh, yeah, who the hell are you?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really entertaining and a great guide to the DC magical universe as well as a great story about a tourist, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, I did enjoy it. I remember you lent it to me a couple of years ago, and it's a great looking book. And
love it.
And yeah, it is one of the. Just as you read out that line of dialogue, it just reminded how awesome Gaiman is when it comes to writing.
He really gets in just a few sort of lines. He kind of tells you all you need to know about a character's personality a lot, especially because he goes through all these crazy characters, some of whom I recognize and a lot of whom I don't, and it's like, okay, I get what they're about pretty quickly. I think he's really effective at that sort of writing. Yeah.
Earthboy Jacobus is my next pick from writer-artist Doug Tennapel, who most of you will be familiar with as the creator of Earthworm Jim, who I think is probably more your side of things than I was more into Street Fighter and whatnot. But,
and you suck.
Street Fighter's awesome. And he's quite a he's written quite a few original graphic novels over the last few years. He doesn't really do or video games or anymore or kind of monthly comics, but he does do these rather hefty original graphic novels. Mm-hmm. Earthboy Jacobus was published by Image Comics in 2005. Got a great quote by creator of Hellboy Mike Mignola on the back, and he's Doug Tennapel is one of those kind of artists. You know, the kind of artists that other artists look up to and admire. So he's got quite a lot of fans in the professional kind of comics community. It's 272 pages. It's quite a hefty tome. It's black and white. His art style, I mean, you can Google and I guess image search will give a more apt description than I can, but it's very kind of loose, brush-like, sketchy. It's obvious that he uses a lot of kind of heavy splotchy inks and that kind of stuff, kind of Chiarusco style, I guess is the best way to describe it. His face is extraordinarily expressive. It is a very simple cartoony style. Sometimes it's a bit hard to see what's going on because it is just black and white. There's no real duotones, no grey shading or anything like that. But it does use silhouettes and that kind of stuff quite well. Basically what happens is there's this guy his name is Chief Edwards. He's a former Marine, and he's just about to retire from the Modesto Police Department. So on his last day of work as a cop, he's driving home and he sees this whale, just a whale sitting on the freeway. No other cars are around, and he's like, what's going on? So his natural instincts kind of kick in. He almost drives into the whale after being shocked, and then he hears something coming out from inside of it. He opens it up, and there's this kid inside. He's kind of wearing this weird sci-fi kind of black bodysuit, I guess, and the kid's kind of startled and he's like, he has no idea where he is. We discover later that he's travelled to our world from another kind of alternate world where kind of these insecty creatures called ectoids kind of roam the land and enslave and imprison people. So it's quite a barren land where you've got like big massive creatures kind of roaming the landscape. The chief basically adopts this kid. And he, you know, kind of looks after him and teaches him and all that kind of stuff. We see that this kid, who he calls Jacobus, Earthboy Jacobus, that's the name of the book. The kid's got these weird marks on him, and we later discover. He goes to public school and all the kids make fun of him. They call him Weird Hand, showing the creativity of kids. Like Weird Hand, Weird Hand. So this kid's like had enough. So Chief Edwards kind of takes him out of school and teaches him all he needs to know. So he teaches him how to fight because he's a former Marine. So there's this great little touching bit where the kids, where Jacob is like really just annoyed and hates that he's being bullied because of his this weird marks on his hand. And then Chief Edwards kind of rolls up his sleeve and shows the little anchor, the Marine tattoo. And he goes, "Do you think anybody made fun of me?" With, you know, not in an angry way, but he's like, "Come on, you know, it's a mark of a man, you know." So he kind of teaches him how to fight for himself and all that kind of stuff. Later, both the book's broken into three chapters. Like, it seems to be about 7 or 8 years apart. So we see both characters grow up throughout the time. So Jacobus going from a scared little kid, later on he's like a teenager and he's like smoking, he's hanging out with the wrong crowd, he's like really worked his way into Earth society, you know, and he's like totally ignoring Chief Edwards, who just loves his son, for lack of a better word, because he practically is. So they're growing more and more apart, and the next 8 years both of them kind of get taken by the Ectoids into the alternate dimension. So it's like we see Jacobus in our world and then we see Edwards in Jacobus's world through the Terra Whale that kind of transformed that transports between dimensions. So most of the book is centered on these two characters, and yeah, it's a great looking book. There's a fair bit of violence and some mild profanity, but it's pretty honest, and the supporting cast is interesting. Like, Edwards falls in love with Jacobus's holographic mother. And that's pretty cool. It is quite funny in parts. And basically, it's kind of just a fight against these whale creatures, and we eventually learned that, these sectoid creatures, we basically eventually learned that Jacobus, who has the weird mark on his hand, is due to the fact that he's immune to the Ectoids' attack. They basically attack people and absorb them, and they become like them, and kind of mind-controlled. It's got quite a happy ending. I won't spoil it for you, but if you can pick it up, I think I picked this up at Comic-Con, I think a couple of years ago. And I know Doug Tenable's got quite a few other graphic novels that he's done, like Power Up, which I've read, is pretty good, Black Cherry, Tomosaurus Rex, Gia, Creature Tech, they've all been quite widely praised. This is certainly an accessible comic, funny in parts, and it did seem almost like a Disney movie, but more of a like a darker Disney movie, like perhaps like a Dark Crystal, I don't know, Dark Crystal Disney, I don't know, but almost like the darker Henson kids movies from the 80s, like Labyrinth or something like that. It's not filled with, you know, wacky sidekicks and weird creatures and that kind of stuff. Like, it's the story itself is quite narrow in its focus. Okay. That just makes it work well. It's like 270 pages, so it obviously has to be quite dialogue and character driven. It's such a great art style. Like, you don't really see that heavy ink wash sketchy kind of style very often, and through the three chapters it's never jarring. Like, we've just skipped ahead 8 years or whatever. Characters age quite well and the relationships are just awesome, and it's quite got some nice bits about faith kind of running through there, because one of the supporting cast is a preacher who's a friend of Edwards, and he gets kidnapped and stuff. So yeah, it's actually it's a good book. It's called Earth by Jacobus by Doug Tenable, available now.
Nice. I feel very honoured to pick this week's number one.
Yeah.
I was going to have... this only really just occurred to me just before we started the podcast, and it's really the best, probably my favourite selection of all of these. It's Guy Delisle's Pyongyang, A Journey in North Korea. It's non-fiction. It's Guy Delisle is, I should say, he's a Canadian who now lives in the south of France. This came out through Drawn and Quarterly a few years ago, and he sort of works as an animation supervisor. So he also writes comics, or draws comics as well, I should say. And he had the opportunity, the honour, of going to North Korea basically for work, which is incredibly rare. He himself says in the pages, North Korea is the world's most isolated country. Foreigners trickle in. There's no internet. There are no cafes. In fact, there's no entertainment. It's hard to even leave the hotel, and meeting Koreans is next to impossible. Luckily, I've had practice being alone, because this won't be a fun house. Well, that's what I thought, but I was wrong, which just goes to show you've got to be ready for anything when you travel. And it really it really is a great travel diary of his time spent in Korea, which starts off with him arriving at the airport. They confiscate his mobile phone and he gets it back when he leaves. Everything else, you can't bring pornography or mobile phones into the country. And he meets the people he's going to work with, and then he meets his Korean translator. And through the course of the novel, he has these little vignettes where they show him around to the sites, and he sees the city, like half of the buildings are only half built, where money's run out, like these dead concrete towers where no one's working in them. And like there's this great scene where he draws at night, which basically shows none of the lights are on in any of the skyscrapers, so it's this completely pitch black city, and all you see is the occasional car driving past. It's like completely dead, this illusion of this the North Korea has tried to build up, of this bustling metropolis. You know, just for saying that, I'll probably be spirited away in the night, so Chris, this may be the last word you ever hear from me. But there's a lot of great culture clash in this, where he learns about the kind of daily tasks people do, their opinions on the West. There's a great scene where he's trying to explain Western music to, because he was allowed to bring CDs and non-and fictional stuff in. It's funny, at the airport he gets caught bringing in a copy of 1984, George Orwell's novel, and the guy's like, "What is this?" And he's like, "Oh, it's a famous novel. It's fiction." And they let him bring it, and he lends it to one of the guys, his translator during the course of the novel, just to see what he'll say afterwards. And it's like, the guy makes no connection in his head at all. He just gives it back and doesn't say a word, so maybe he does recognize, but he can't say anything. There's a great bit where he's trying to explain reggae to them, and then he says, "Well, needless to say, reggae isn't a North Korean kind of thing." So, like he visits the National Museum of North Korea, and they enter this room where he has to have his shirt straightened before he goes in and his hair combed, and there's this wax sculpture of Kim Il Sung, the original one. Kim Il Sung, I think, is still the president legally of North Korea. Kim Jong Il is like the grand leader, but I think technically Kim Il Sung is still. I think I got the name right. Yeah, Kim Il Sung. Yeah, and there's a 22-meter bronze statue of him in the main square. this is really an amazing piece of work, and you see on the back, like Time Magazine, Entertainment Weekly, Newsweek, all major publications have really recognized this is really a great piece of work and a very rare look into North Korea. And it's good because it's on a human level, because he really talks to the people he works with in the animation studio and stuff, and just doesn't really argue with them about the regime or anything. He just kind of gets their opinion on things. He sees various things that we're not aware of here, and the kind of stuff that you can see under the current of everyday life, like you can sort of have... You would be kind of defensive of your country if you were there. Like, who are you to judge a country? And you get that impression. Yeah. And there's all sorts of little funny stories where he writes, he pulls out pages of his storyboards and throws them out the window of the tower just to hand them out to people. Just really bizarre things that happens in it. Trying the food, and he just describes it as very greasy and like, but not very tasty. And it's like just... I think it makes up this wonderful portrait over the whole graphic novel of this country, which nearly all of us will never ever get to visit, which makes it incredibly kind of unusual and striking. And yes, he experiences a few of those grand displays of adoration that the people are forced to put on for Kim Jong-il. You know, there's the cover of the novel has all these girls sort of lined up on a stage, and they're all playing these accordions, and it's because he had to go to this recital, and like these little six-year-old girls are really concentrating, but they're forced to put on these showgirl smiles. It's this really creepy cover. They all look like the Joker, because they're doing like Miss America smiles while playing this incredibly complicated instrument. Really interesting book. It's called Pyongyang, that's Pyongyang, A Journey in North Korea, by Guy Delisle. Delisle is spelled Dlisle, so look him up. Great non-fiction piece of work, and that's the number one.
Wow. Oof. I think we've covered a lot of different bases there, a lot of different genres, but the themes are all pretty similar, so that's a good reading list there.
All right. That wraps us up for this week's show of Extra Sequential, hosted out of Perth, Australia, by me, Mladen, and that guy, Chris.
Yes.
It's a Saturday afternoon.
If you want to catch all of our previous episodes, you can at extrasequential.com. And we're also on iTunes. If you want to email us, it's Chris with a K, Chris at extrasequential, one word, com. We don't know what we're going to be talking about next week, do we? Probably not.
I have a suspicion. I wanted to talk about buying habits of comics.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Whether
I do buy and you do buy.
We do buy. Ha, ha, ha. But whether you do graphic novels or comics, or whether you wait for trades, or whether you just wait 50 years until you hear that something's really, really good and then you read it, or if you only read something from 1920, you know, a lot of people have really different reading habits. So, and I know you and I really differ on how we shop for comics. So,
yes, well, and my habits have been have changed over the last year or so as well. So yeah. I think between the two of us, we'll certainly make it an interesting discussion.
Mm. And over the next couple of weeks, I really want to have an argument with you about Kingdom Come. Now, this is a sore topic for us, but yeah, it's been a long time coming, and I'm ready to explain why it's terrible.
I'm so fragile, I can't put up with your rambling rants.
All right, I'll talk to you next week, and you'll hear us next week. See you, folks.
We'll do. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.